Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Wednesday, December 2nd. I'm your reader, Chris Klein. First, let's take a brief look at eastern Iowa weather. Today is partly cloudy, winds from the northwest 5 to 10 miles an hour. In Cedar Rapids, a high of 41 and a low of 20. Tomorrow, partly cloudy, high of 37, low of 21. Sunset tonight at 4:36 p.m., sunrise tomorrow, 7:17 a.m. And now from the front page of today's Gazette. Derecho's toll on Cedar Rapids businesses, over $133 million. Half of survey respondents expect insurance coverage. This is written by Marissa Payne. A sampling of 111 Cedar Rapids businesses have told the city they lost a combined $133.4 million because of the August 10th derecho that pummeled eastern Iowa with hurricane force. About half of the companies responded to a city survey reported they expected insurance to cover the costs of storm damage, but some city council members said Tuesday the results will prompt a look at ways the city could step in to boost a local economy already hampered by the COVID-19 pandemic. Now we've got to figure out what role the city can play in helping our economy recover, said Mayor Brad Hart. Businesses representing a variety of industries, including service, retail, industry, nonprofits, and wholesale, responded to the survey, and the sample also encompasses small, medium, and large companies. 90% of the losses come from three categories, according to the survey. Structural and property damage, $69.3 million, lost revenue from the missed sales, $41.4 million, and unpaid. Wages, $9.1 million. Councilmember Marty Hoger noted the differences in insurance coverage between the 2008 flood and the 2020 derecho, both natural disasters, but ones that have different requirements for coverage. In 2008, a lot of businesses did not have insurance to cover them, Hoger said, asking whether the city had identified any particular gaps in insurance coverage for the losses from the derecho. City Economic Development Specialist David Connolly said the city received little feedback about that, but the claims process was ongoing as the city was asking for data immediately following the storm. The storm, which downed hundreds of trees and caused extended power outages, disrupted internet and cell phone service, and initially made some roads impassable, resulted in lost days in operation for local businesses. Of the respondents, 32.1% reported losing 2 weeks or more, and 22.6% lost more than 1 week. The others lost a range of 1 to 5 or 6 days, except for about 1% that remained open. The survey found the storm's impact on employment levels to be minimal, Connolly said. The questionnaire asked whether companies planned any layoffs or job reductions in 2020. Only about 16% of the companies that responded, a total of 17 or 18 companies, indicated changes to staffing are likely. Companies reported fewer than 75 positions overall would be negatively affected because of the derecho. The minimum loss figure calculated from responses to the storm loss questionnaire developed by the City Economic Development Services Division does not include losses in the public sector or among homeowners. It is intended to provide a scale of damage to implement programs and establish priorities to address business needs moving forward. Cedar Rapids officials in October estimated city losses from the derecho to range from $60 million to $80 million, not including the cost to replenish the lost tree canopy on city land. The city expects to be on the hook for about 15% of the reimbursement eligible costs, with the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the state covering the rest. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration estimates that derecho took an economic toll ranging from $7.5 billion to $10 billion across the Midwest, making it the most costly thunderstorm in U.S. history. The report, acknowledging uncertainty about the impact of potential storms in the future, said one of the most effective long-term mitigation actions any local government can take is to continue to strengthen and diversify the local tax base. Taking action to support the feasible provision of infrastructure and utility services within planned growth areas, combined with economic development policy supporting increase in the number of businesses and jobs present in the community, helps to sustain the financial resources necessary to effectively manage and the cost of any future natural disasters, the report stated. High quality growth also adds to public facility and public service capacity to help with future disaster recovery as well. Next is the headline, 45% of Iowa waters impaired, review finds. Lake McBride, parts of Cedar and Iowa rivers on list. This is by Aaron Jordan for the Gazette. Iowa has fewer lakes, rivers, and streams on its 2020 draft list of impaired waters compared with the 2018 review cycle, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources reported. For the first time, there was an overall decrease in the number of combined categories 4 and 5 impairments, Ken Krier, K-R-I-E-R, senior environmental specialist, said Tuesday in a news conference. Still, 45% of 1,300 water body segments reviewed for the 2020 list are impaired, meaning they don't meet at least one standard for their intended use, such as drinking, recreation, or supporting aquatic life. Iowa's 2020 draft list of the most serious Category 5 impaired waters has 775 impairments on 586 segments of lakes, streams, rivers, and wetlands. This is a small decrease from the 838 impairments on 622 water body segments on the 2018 final list approved by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. The 2020 numbers still could go up or down based on public feedback, which can be submitted through December 31st at ircomment@dnr.iowa.gov. The biggest water quality problem for Iowa's rivers and streams is bacteria, while lakes and reservoirs suffer most from algae growth, Krier said. More than one-third of the fish kills included in the report were caused by animal waste. Eastern Iowa water bodies included on the impaired waters list are part of the Cedar River and Iowa River, as well as Lake McBride near Solon, Kent Park Lake near Tiffin, and Backbone Lake near Dundee. There are a large number of impairments due to nutrients and manure, said Pat Mackey-Taylor, chapter director for the Sierra Club's Iowa chapter. They have them in categories as sediment, algae, fish kills, and bacteria, but a lot of the causes can be lumped together as manure or nutrients. The Iowa DNR removed 99 water body segments from the list, with about two-thirds delisted because agency staff completed plans for their future cleanup. Those plans called total maximum daily load bump waters down from Category 5 to Category 4. Wally Taylor, conservation chair of the Sierra Club's Iowa chapter, said the Iowa DNR needs to carry out those plans. A TMDL is simply a statement or plan as to what needs to be done, he said. By itself, it does not clean up the water. The Sierra Club also was critical of the Sierra Club is also critical of the Iowa DNR for assessing only 1,300 water body segments compared with 1,422 in the 2018 cycle. Krier said there was a decrease in segments assessed for 2020 because data that had been included in the past now was considered outdated. Segments of the Cedar River between Vinton and Cedar Rapids were removed from the impaired waters list because water monitoring has shown pH levels have fallen in a safe range for two review cycles. The state reported segments can be delisted for one problem, but left on the list for others. Although the Iowa DNR has been compiling an impaired waters list every other year since 1998, officials caution against using it to find long-term trends. Each year's report includes data for the previous 5 years, and sometimes there are changes in the amount of monitoring done and methodology for monitoring. Our next headline on the front page is UI epidemiologist more optimistic about virus, but Iowans should hunker down a little bit longer. This is by Vanessa Miller, Iowa City. After COVID-19 admissions at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics soared into the 90s earlier this month, the number of patients in the facility dropped into the 60s this week, giving UI epidemiologist Jorge Salinas reason to remain hopeful, but also vigilant about the prolonged pandemic. "Lately, I am more optimistic," Selena said Tuesday during a question and answer session on Facebook Live. He noted that at the same time, an advisory committee for the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention was discussing which groups of people should get the first doses of a vaccine. "A vaccine that is 95% effective in preventing infection," he noted. Salinas, however, also pointed out the recent surge in infections and the need to hunker down a little bit longer to prevent as many hospitalizations and deaths as possible. In November, UIHC, as well as the state and nation, saw the most cases diagnosed, the most hospitalizations, the most patients in intensive care, the most deaths compared to other months in the pandemic. "The good news is that our number of hospitalizations has decreased slightly over the last week," he said. As to whether Iowa and UIHC will see another spike following the Thanksgiving holidays, Selena said that remains to be seen. If it's going to happen, it would be in the next week or two. What's clear is that other states that had a lower incidence will have a growing incidence as a result of the holiday, Selena said. If somebody travels from a state of high incidence to a state of low incidence, cases will follow that gradient. Because the Midwest already had high COVID-19 incidence, the holidays may not lead necessarily to a very high second spike. "That's my hope," he said. "But that's completely contingent on the public health measure implementation that Iowans do." And Salinas urged Iowans to adhere to all the mitigation measures, not just some of them. Wear masks, socially distance, wash hands, monitor symptoms, and stay home if sick. With another holiday coming up, Salinas urged diligence in squashing large group gatherings in exchange for resuming celebrations next summer and after. "It's very likely the 4th of July will be nice. Next Halloween will be nice. Thanksgiving next year will probably be back to normal if we get all these vaccines and therapeutics," he said. "So yes, there's light at the end of the tunnel. As far how to stay safe as vaccines are distributed over the months to come, Salinas noted that protection is not established until a week after taking the second dose, referring to the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines under consideration for emergency use. "We think it's going to be useful for everybody to continue wearing masks for the time being," he said. "But if everybody in your family and everybody in your household and members of another household have received the vaccine after a week of the second dose, your immunity that the vaccine provides you is 95%. Now for Iowa Today. Cedar Rapids police ID man shot to death Monday. He was released from prison last month. This is written by Trish Mahahey for the Gazette. Cedar Rapids. A 24-year-old Hiawatha man who was released from prison last month after serving time for shooting at three people was identified by police Tuesday as the person fatally shot Monday at a home in Northwest Cedar Rapids. Charles James Griffin's body was found by police at 10:54 a.m. and inside a home in the 400 block of F Avenue Northwest. Police confirmed this is a homicide investigation and say they think it was a targeted shooting. Nobody has been arrested and the investigation continues. Police said Monday a person of interest was being questioned. According to court documents, Griffin was convicted last year for lesser charges of carrying weapons and intimidation with a dangerous weapon. He originally was charged with three counts of attempted murder for firing multiple shots at three people who were in a parked vehicle outside his Hiawatha home, and then continued shooting at the vehicle as they drove away, according to a criminal complaint. Officers recovered over 20 shell casings from a .40 caliber weapon found in the area, the complaint showed. They also searched his home and recovered an empty box of a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson handgun that police believed was used in the shooting. Griffin was sentenced to 5 years in prison but was released November 18th and was on parole. He had previous convictions for first-degree harassment and disorderly conduct. Next article is Cedar Rapids works with group to help at-risk youth achieve dreams. This is by Marissa Payne. Excuse me. A local nonprofit dedicated to fostering youth leadership started as an after-school basketball program and now will help students get a shot at achieving their dreams through a new city collaboration. The Cedar Rapids City Council on Tuesday approved a 2-year agreement starting this month through November 2022 to contribute $100,000 to support the Leaders, Believers, Achievers Foundation's Cedar Rapids Outreach Program, a new partnership with local groups and agencies to connect at-risk youth and the community. The program's cost is budgeted about $75,000 annually, said Carrie Crowell, the organization's strategic director. He told the council he hoped its support and the backing of community and business leaders would help it grow. Cedar Rapids Police Sergeant Laura Faircloth said the organization has been around since 2011 and now provides an array of services to help at-risk youths achieve their dreams. The partnership with the city will help build bridges between youth and local law enforcement as well as the broader community, she said, introducing them to new people and opportunities they otherwise might not have been able to access. We know that there's a saying that if you haven't seen something, you can't dream it, Crowell said. Their vision of what's available to them and what's realistic for them in their future is very limited in scope, and oftentimes that's because they haven't had exposures to some great careers and opportunities. Crowell said a mobile app developed by the LBA Foundation will be used to connect youth with mentors such as law enforcement, business, and municipal leaders. It will give them tasks and challenges, support and feedback to track engagement with activities in the program tied to their own dreams, while helping the organization measure the program's success and influence. Students may then earn rewards tied to their participation in the program, including gift cards and movie and sporting events tickets. The Parks and Recreation and Police Departments will work with the foundation to host 4 events and coordinate activities throughout the year-long program, according to the proposal. By going throughout Cedar Rapids, we're going to be able to share with them some different businesses, different careers, different jobs and roles, and open their eyes to some different opportunities and hopefully instill in them a belief that there are great opportunities for them moving forward, Crowell said. And we're going to help them create a roadmap for them to get from today to one of these opportunities that perhaps they never even knew was available. Al O'Bannon, the nonprofit's executive director And the organization said the organization serves more than 350 youth, helping them with academics, health and leadership, and financial literacy. O'Bannon said, there have been 7 deaths to gun violence among leaders, believers, achievers, kids through the years. He wants to let disillusioned youth know of alternatives to be successful in life. City Council member Dale Todd, who leads the council's Youth Services and Public Safety Committee, said, this partnership will fill a gap in recreational programming and in opportunities for youth to build relations with local law enforcement. Now, to Insight. Here's a piece called by guest column, Iowa Commission on Native American Affairs, End Use of Native Mascots. The NFL stadiums and in the high school bleachers of states across the nation, we have witnessed an evolution in mainstream views on the use of Native American mascots, nicknames, and imagery. Iowa school districts and communities have an opportunity to be on the forefront of this movement and should likewise evolve beyond the use of Native mascots. The use of Native symbols and likenesses is inarguably degrading and hurtful to Native people who are forced to see themselves reduced to mere caricatures and their cultures co-opted for purposes divorced from Native self-determination. For nearly 30 years, mental health professionals have noted that the use of Native mascots is measurably detrimental to Native people. For this reason, agencies like the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, the American Sociological Association, the Modern Language Association, the National Education Association, the American Psychological Association, and the National Collegiate Athletic Association have adopted rules intended to eliminate or discourage the use of Native mascots. The use of Native mascots is contrary to Iowa's reputation for offering students a world-class education. The use of Native team nicknames gives students and fans the impression that Native people are purely historical or even fictional. Iowa's Native population includes more than 16,000 people. This number has grown substantially during the past 2 decades and reflects a population that is younger, on average, than Iowa's total population and resides mostly in Iowa's urban areas. Natives are not considered to history books or a distant frontier. Natives are not consigned to history books or a distant frontier. They are your neighbors and a vital thriving segment of Iowa's population. There is no reason to undermine schools' efforts to produce informed citizens by encouraging an inaccurate view of Native people through the continued use of Native mascots. We at the Iowa Commission on Native American Affairs encourage you to consider the harms and risks associated with the use of Native mascots, nicknames, and imagery. Permanent removal of these outdated symbols is necessary to ensure Iowa's schools retain their reputation as some of the nation's best and continue our tradition of equitable and thoughtful education. We urge you to join leaders in education from across the country and adopt a policy banning Native mascots, nicknames, and imagery from your schools and school district. Now, here is a community letter. Private landowners must clean up damaged trees. While driving along East Post Road recently, I spotted a large sign advertising land for sale along a large expanse of wooded acres. The land is owned by a developer who no doubt purchased the land to one day sell it and make a profit. Now, however, when I look at these wooded acres, all I can see are hundreds of devastated trees that need to be cut down and hauled away so that the land can begin the long process of healing itself. Developers throughout the cities and rural areas of Linn County, these trees now are your responsibility. You did not plan for this responsibility, but you must accept it and care for these trees. The cities and county will spend millions of dollars cleaning up and replanting our tree canopy. The very least private owners can do is remove the scars from our neighborhoods. Our community never will be the same after the August 10th derecho, but our trees at least deserve to be given the respect and removal they deserve after they have given us so many years of enjoyment and protection. This is written and submitted by Vicki Hughes of Marion. Now we have time for one more guest column, Hans Haus. another victim of COVID-19. I miss the power of a crowded theater. Last year in September, film scene. I don't know, this goes on and on. I'm going to read a different one, excuse me, by Jerry and Tale Hale. Reynolds' response has been feeble. Governor Kim Reynolds' November 19th news conference focused on the growing incidence of COVID in Iowa's nursing homes and the workforce shortages that exist. Many questions have been asked. Here are some of them and our comments. Question: how much of the concern about the growth of COVID relates to the workforce available to care for nursing home residents? Are staffing levels adequate? Answer: nursing home industry spokespeople say that staffing levels have been and are adequate. We strongly disagree. Staffing levels were inadequate and unacceptable before the pandemic, and they are even worse now. Question: the governor's guidance on workforce shortages assumes that there are extra staff members who just need to be identified and loaned to struggling facilities. Is this true? Answer: no. There's no pool of extra workers. Hospitals, nursing homes, assisted living centers, and home care agencies are all understaffed. Governors and legislators have known about the workforce for years, but have done little more than talk about it. Elected officials who set legislative priorities have regarded these workforce issues as insignificant and not worthy of their time. The chickens now have come home to roost. Their inaction has produced disastrous consequences. We need to deal with this crisis now. Elected leaders like to describe frontline staff members as heroes, but they do nothing to ensure they are treated and compensated as such. It's well past time to have nice words backed up with meaningful action. Question: the governor's guidance on workers says that the use of temporary help from staffing agencies should be part of the solution. What are the ramifications? Answer: potentially not good. Studies have shown that temporary employees who travel from facility to facility can carry the virus with them, spread it from one facility to another, and make a bad situation worse. Question: the governor's new guidance also says that infected staff can be used to care for non-infected residents as a last resort. Is that wise? Answer: the idea raises all kinds of red flags. The situation in nursing homes has gone from bad to desperate when government says it's okay for infected staff members to care for uninfected residents. While desperate times might call for desperate measures, there are better approaches. Iowa should consider doing what other states have done. Use the National Guard to support existing staff members. If this is a war, let's fight it like one. Question: the governor is routing an additional $14 million in taxpayer dollars to Iowa nursing homes to help with the COVID crisis. What kind of rules and transparency should govern the flow of these dollars? Answer: there is specific parameters for use of the additional dollars and transparency on where they flow and how they are used. We believe dollars should be used to give wage increases to existing staff and to raise the wage floor for all newly hired staff. Question: what are your thoughts overall? Answer: sadly, the governor's latest statements and actions simply document how feeble, tardy, and inadequate the government's response has been in recognizing and dealing with the COVID and workforce crisis in long-term care settings, resulting in more sickness, suffering, and death. For 9 months, journalists have been documenting what was unfolding, and advocates have been pleading for action. The only voices state government has seriously listened to are those of the trade associations, which represent the interests of owners and operators of nursing homes. Nursing home residents, families, frontline workers, and those who advocate for them have not been given a seat at the table. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, December 2nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. There are quite a few of them today, I'm sorry to say. From Cedar Rapids, Ron W. Rickleffs, 54, died Sunday, November 29th. Papich Kuba Funeral Service, Cedar Rapids. Dyersville, Michael P. Kelly, 67, died Tuesday, December 1st. Kramer Funeral Home, Dyersville. Iowa City, Sandra K. Sandy Wieland, 78, died Monday, November 30th. Snyder and Hollenbog Funeral and Cremation Services, Lone Tree. Kelowna, Barbara Potarf, 75, died Saturday, November 28th, Yoder Powell Funeral Home, Kelowna. Maquoketa, Shirley A. Momsen, 83, died Monday, November 30th, Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. Maquoketa, Gerald E. Jerry Willie, 75, of Castle Pines, Colorado, formerly of Maquoketa, died Sunday, November 29th, Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. McGregor, Lila Eleanor Shellhammer Weipert, 89, died Monday, November 30th, Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, McGregor. Preston, Arlene H. Nolting, 90, died Monday, November 30th, Carson Celebration of Life Center, Maquoketa. Sigourney, Lois Joyce Edmondson Batchelder, 89, died Monday, November 30th, Powell Funeral Home, Sigourney. Tama, the Reverend Stephen Ray Nurnes, 68, died Monday, November 30th, Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo. Vinton, Chance C.J. Walker, 35, died Monday, November 30th, Van Steehuysen Russell Funeral Home, Vinton. West Liberty, Waldo Richard Dick Myers, 89, died Monday, November 30th, Henderson Barker Funeral Home, West Liberty. Now, the other obituaries begin with a picture in memory of Neil P. Brown, born 12/18/1943, died December 2nd, 2000. 20 years have passed without you. We miss you every day, love you always and forever, your family. Jan C. Janacek, 75, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Friday, November 27th. At Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Private interment will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Gerald Jerry Evans, 81, of Cedar Rapids, passed peacefully at home Wednesday, November 25th, under the care of Hospice of Mercy. Private family memorial services, 2 p.m. Saturday, December 19th, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Cedar Rapids. It will be streamed online. Fremont Monty H. Gall, 93, of Tipton, passed away Wednesday, November 25th, at Crestridge Care Center in Maquoketa. A private service for family members is being planned for next spring at the Masonic Cemetery in Tipton. John W. McGee died on Tuesday, December 1st. Cremation will be interred at Cedar Memorial, 4200 First Avenue Northeast, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Roger L. Norton of Cedar Rapids passed away on Wednesday, November 25th, after a short illness. A mass of Christian burial with a celebration following will be held in the spring of 2021. Mary Alice Turner Western, 93, of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, November 25th, at home peacefully. Deborah Ann Harper Snodgrass died Saturday, November 28th. At Deb's request, no services will be held. Memorials can be directed to the family. Richard W. Booth, 82, of rural Independence, Iowa, died Saturday, November 28th, at Allen Memorial Hospital in Waterloo, Iowa. Private services will be held Wednesday, December 2nd at Cedar Memorial Park in Cedar Rapids. A memorial fund has been established. Arlene H. Troyer, 86, of Iowa City, passed away November 30th of COVID-19. Yoder Powell Funeral Home is caring for Arlene and her family. Because of COVID-19, there will be no visitation. The family is planning a celebration of life at a later date to be announced. Mary Louise Shakespeare Summers, 100, of Central City, who died on November 30th. Private services will be held at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories on Saturday, December 5th at 3 p.m. Bernadine May Treban, Stanford, 94, died peacefully in her sleep on November 28th. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Rife Family Center Funeral Home and Crematory is assisting the family with arrangements. Robert Bob D. Hartley, 90, of Wellman, Iowa, formerly of Washington, Iowa, died Monday, November 30th, at Parkview Home in Wellman. Betty Genevieve Jean Erlaub of Garnavillo was born in 1925, and making her 95 years old, she died on November 30th. Arrangements are being handled by Tukey Allen Funeral Home, Industrial Park Road, Garnaville, Iowa. Eldon Walter Weiss, 92, of Williamsburg, passed away peacefully Monday, November 30th, at Keystone Nursing Care Center. A private funeral service will be held at St. John's Lutheran Church, Marengo. Burial will be at Marengo Cemetery. And now on to sports. Hawks hope to play all 8 of their games. COVID has not affected Iowa football team yet. This is by Jeff Johnson for the Gazette. Wisconsin was first, then it was Maryland, now it's Ohio State, Minnesota, and maybe Michigan. The Wolverines didn't practice Tuesday. Only 6 teams in the Big Ten Conference have played their full complement of football games this COVID season, a number that will shrink to at least 5 this week. Northwestern's games against Minnesota is off, dropping the Wildcats from the list, but perhaps clinching the West Division championship because of it. That's so 2020. Yet while Wisconsin, Maryland, OSU, Minnesota, and perhaps now Michigan have had to shut things down in their programs because of coronavirus outbreaks, Iowa has just kept on keeping on. The Hawkeyes, 4-2, have gotten in all 6 of their games, and at least as of last night, were on the schedule to play Saturday at Illinois, 2:30 p.m. I don't know that we are doing anything magical or anything like that, Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said Tuesday afternoon. I don't want to make it sound like we are doing something nobody else is doing, because I don't think that's the case at all. I think part of it is luck. I really believe that. As a human being and coach, I certainly believe there's an element of luck involved. That's just a non-scientist, non-scientific background looking at this whole thing. Iowa hasn't had any of its most key personnel test COVID positive during the season and miss games. Everyone is tested daily. Starting guard Kyler Schott and middle linebacker Jack Campbell both missed 3 games each, but that was because of mononucleosis. Luck is probably playing a role with that, as Ferentz mentioned. But it also surely means players are doing the right things to try and protect themselves and their teammates. I think it shows us as a team how committed we are and how we do things we've got to do to stay COVID-free and to keep people from being at risk, wide receiver Brandon Smith said, following the things we need to do following the protocols. We're super fortunate, guard Cole Banwart said. I think that's just a testament to our character, just being cautious and being smart away from the building and staying away from the building. Being smart away from the building. Making sure you have your mask on, social distancing, using hand sanitizer, washing our hands, just being careful everywhere we go so that we don't get sick and bring it into the building and get everybody else sick. Iowa has had good timing when it comes to its opponents. The Hawkeyes played 3 weeks ago at Minnesota, with the Gophers being on pause now for a 2nd straight week. Wisconsin had to shut down for 2 weeks early in the season, but Iowa doesn't play it until the regular season finale next week. The Hawkeyes' 8-game schedule doesn't include Ohio State, Maryland, or Michigan. Being away to avoid cancellations is definitely a great thing, Smith said. The only thing everybody has been hearing since March, just try to do the obvious things, Kurt Ferentz said. Try to practice good hygiene. Try to keep your distance from people. I don't want to speak for all of our players, but I think most of them are probably doing what we do as coaches. We come to work and go home. I don't think anybody has got much of a social life right now. Indiana, Rutgers, Penn State, and Michigan are the other Big Ten schools to get in all of their games so far, with Michigan's game Saturday against Maryland in doubt. Wisconsin has played just 3 games and Ohio State 4, with its game Saturday against Michigan State also in doubt. That would leave both the Badgers and Buckeyes without enough games to even qualify for the Big Ten championship. Game in 2 weeks in Indianapolis. Ferentz was asked if he felt a true league champion would be crowned considering the discrepancy in games the conference teams have had. No idea, he replied. Not to be smug, but I really don't care, quite frankly. I just hope we get to keep playing games. Coaches and players, this is what we like doing. So selfishly, I'm looking at it kind of selfishly right now, but we have been given an opportunity to do that, and it is an opportunity we are appreciative of, knowing it could end tomorrow. Quick slants. Wide receiver Emar Smith-Marset spoke publicly for the first time since his late October arrest for suspicion of drunken driving. Smith-Marset was suspended for 1 game. After it all happened, I felt down. I felt like I let the whole team down. The coaching staff, my teammates, my family, myself, Smith-Marset said. But I talked to Coach Ferentz, and I moved past it. The whole week, I was just coming back in and trying to work hard to get the trust of my teammates again. Let them know that mistakes happen, and I will do anything I can to show that I am with you 100%. Then it was just move on past it. I'm fully focused, going out there each and every week, putting my best foot forward and doing what I can to try and help us improve each week. Ferentz said tackle Coy Kronk could see field time Saturday. A grad transfer from Indiana, Kronk started the first 2 games on the right side but has missed 4 games with an ankle problem. He dressed for this past Saturday's game against Nebraska, but did not play. Here's an article about Caitlin Clark, written by Jeff Linder. Hawks Clark back in Des Moines for tonight's Drake game. Divide and conquer. That, according to Caitlin Clark, will be the attendance strategy for her parents, Brent and Ann. It's also the game Caitlin and her big brother, Blake, are playing in the college sports world. Blake is a backup quarterback and placement holder for the Iowa State football team, which is reaching heights it has not seen before. Caitlin is a rookie basketball player at the University of Iowa and the Big Ten Freshman of the Week. Tonight, she'll appear at the Knapp Center, a frequent childhood haunt for her and Blake. I went to a lot of games here, Caitlin said Monday. The Knapp Center was 15 minutes away from home in West Des Moines, so my brother and dad and I went a lot. They have that little blimp that does a lot of stuff. I'm excited to go play there. The Hawkeyes 1-0 visit Drake 1-1 with a 6 p.m. tip-off. Clark earned the season's first Big Ten weekly award after debuting with a 27-point outburst in the Hawkeyes' 96-81 victory over Northern Iowa last Wednesday. Her first game was pretty good, Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said. You never know how it's going to translate to the college game. It translated well. Offensively, I think it was really good, Clark said. We scored 96 points. We could have done even better. At times, we played too fast. The Hawkeyes follow tonight's game with a Big Ten opener Saturday at home against Wisconsin. That starts at 2 p.m., 30 minutes before Iowa State wraps up its football regular season against West Virginia. Blake's team is ranked number 12 in the country. It's awesome, Caitlin said. Blake loves Iowa State football, and it's great to see him so happy. When they're in the Big 12 championship November 19th, I told my parents they'd both better be at the game. But when we're both playing Saturday, our parents probably will divide and conquer. Clark won't be the only influential rookie on the floor tonight. Drake's Grace Berg is the Missouri Valley Conference newcomer of the week. The sophomore from Indianola and a transfer from Missouri scored 34 points as the Bulldogs split games against Creighton and Green Bay. They've got people we have to be worried about, Bluter said. Grace Berg is a really good player. She can score from all 3 areas. She rebounds and runs the floor well. Maddie Monahan is an outstanding three-point shooter. Kiera Collier is quick and defends well. Iowa's non-conference schedule will be half completed after tonight. The Hawkeyes' other two non-Big Ten games are against Iowa State and Western Illinois, both at home, December 9th and December 22nd. Our non-conference schedule, we did what we were advised to do, Bluter said. Try to play at home if possible and play teams that are close. Now for sideline. Iowans in NBA. Cook, Utah signed deals for 2021. Former Iowa basketball player Tyler Cook is back in the NBA, and the ex-Hawkeye Jared Utah appears to be headed that way as well. Cook signed a camp deal with the Minnesota Timberwolves, and Utah reportedly will hook on with the New Orleans Pelicans. Cook is a second-year pro. He played 11 games with the Cleveland Cavaliers and two with the Denver Nuggets last season and played in 29 NBA G League games. Will Guillory, who covers the Pelicans for the Atlantic, reported Monday that Utah was signed a one-year non-guaranteed contract with that team. Utah's last season at Iowa was 2015 to 2016. He has played in a total of 16 NBA games spanning three short stints with the Dallas Mavericks, Memphis Grizzlies, and Washington Wizards. He has played in 121 G League games. He averaged 19 points per game last season for the G League's Memphis Hustle. Next, Garza Weiskamp on wooden watch list. College basketball. A pair of Hawkeyes were named to the John R. Wooden Award preseason top 25 watch list. Senior All-American Luca Garza was named, as was junior Joe Weiskamp. Garza earned a National Player of the Year honors from six national media outlets last season and was also the Big Ten Player of the Year. He scored a school record of 740 points last season. Weiskamp, also named to the Jerry West Award watch list, was a third-team All-Big Ten pick last season. He was second on the team with 14.0 points and a 6.1 rebounds per game. Women's basketball. Wooden Award lists Iowa State's Ashley Jones was named to the John R. Wooden Award preseason top 30 watch list. Jones, an Iowa City High grad, has averaged 30.5 points and 9.5 rebounds in her first two games this season. She is one of five Big 12 players on the list. College football, ISU 9th, Iowa 19th in latest CFP rankings. Iowa State is ranked 9th and Iowa is 19th in the latest college football playoff rankings released last night. They were 13th and 24th, respectively, the previous week. The top four spots belong to, in order, Alabama, Notre Dame, Clemson, and Ohio State. The next four are Texas A&M, Florida, Cincinnati, and Georgia. Now for a couple, if we have time, additional articles. This one is Iowa adds 1,878 new virus cases. This is by Gage Miskimmon for the Gazette. Hospitalizations tick upward after declines. For the third day in a row, the number of COVID-19 tests reported by the state dipped below 5,000 on Tuesday as the average number of new positive cases added each day over the course of the week also declined. Public health data shows Iowa added 1,878 coronavirus cases in a 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. Tuesday. Of the 4,555 tests run in the period, 2,677 of them were negative or inconclusive. That brought the state's seven-day rolling average of new cases to 2,184 a day, making for declines in each of the last seven days. The new cases bring the state's total so far to 230,897. Iowa also confirmed 24 additional COVID-19 deaths in the period, bringing the total number of Iowans who have died because of the virus to 2,427. Clayton County recorded three of the new deaths. Counties with two deaths each were Benton, Blackhawk, Ciro, Gordo, Jones, and Louisa. Counties recording one death each were Dickinson, Harrison, Lynn, Marion, Mitchell, Muscatine, Polk, Scott, Washington, Webster, and Winnebago. Hospitalizations across the state ticked up again, rising from 1,162 to 1,172. Patients in intensive care increased from 224 to 235 patients on ventilators, dipping from 147 to 144, but patients on ventilators dipped. According to state figures released Tuesday morning, the total number of cases in Linn County since the pandemic arrived in Iowa dropped by 20 cases for a total of 14,356. Asked about the discrepancy, Linn County Public Health referred questions to the Iowa Department of Public Health. That department did not give an explanation Tuesday afternoon. Johnson County added 78 new cases for a total of 9,662 and a 7-day average of 73. Of the new cases reported Tuesday morning, 177 were school-age children, up to 17. Bringing the total number of minors infected in Iowa to 22,888. There were also 7 new cases reported of individuals within the education occupation category, bringing the total to 7,618. As of Tuesday, there were 162 outbreaks at long-term care facilities in the state, an increase of 6 since Monday. The number of deaths within long-term care facilities increased by 6 over the period as well, bringing the total to 1,069 so far. Locally, Terrace Glen Village in Marion was added to the state's outbreak list with 1 case. Hy-Vee launches membership program. Hy-Vee has launched a premium membership program that will let customers receive free delivery and 2-hour express pickup, the West Des Moines-based grocery chain said this week. The program Hy-Vee Plus costs $99 per year. It also offers an extra 3 cents in fuel saver rewards, access to its Redline premium customer service team, and exclusive deals every month. This membership is unlike any other program in the industry and blends our greatest services, both in-store and online, into an affordable experience and brings incredible value. And Randy Ekbar's chairman, CEO, and president of Hy-Vee said in a news release. Any member of the existing Hy-Vee Aisle online program, which charges $99 per year for free delivery, will become a Hy-Vee Plus member. The employee-owned grocer has more than a dozen corridor locations. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, December 2nd. I'm your reader, Chris Klein. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. Flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Xofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once weekly or twice monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.